I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Joseph Heller, where are you? The author of Catch-22 despaired over the twisted nature of military language. His character, General Peckham, observed that a bomb pattern is a term I just dreamed up several weeks ago. It means nothing, but you'd be surprised at how rapidly it's caught on. Why, I've got all sorts of people convinced that if I think it's important for the bombs to explode close together and make a neat aerial photograph. Heller noted something back in 1961 that has been increasingly apparent ever since, that beyond truth, one of the other great casualties of war is the precision of language. The words of the military are often used to distort and to disguise, and with each new conflict, new phrases are invented which find their way into everyday use. Shell shock from the First World War, blitz from the Second, the First Gulf War gave us the infamous mother of all battles. Let's pray that we don't inherit shock and awe from this one. Connection listeners, are you listening to the language of war with Iraq? How are you hearing language used? Are you hearing it used to sanitize or desensitize the horror of war today? Are the words used to describe war part of a psychological battle to win hearts on the home front? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today with Nicholas Watt. He's a political correspondent for The Guardian. He's joining us from London. Hello, Nicholas.
Hi there.
You're writing a new daily column called The Language of War, Decoding the Military Jargon. Was there one such phrase that triggered your decision or the paper's decision to go ahead with this?
Well, interestingly, what got us going on this was not the actual war. It was the final sort of round of diplomacy, and it was the British ambassador to the United Nations in New York who famously comes up with these great sort of Foreign Office phrases. And the one that attracted our attention was he talked about how Britain was failing to achieve traction in the Security Council for the great second resolution, which they never got. It's a very sort of senior people in the Foreign Office really pride themselves in sort of coming up with this sort of imaginative language. And we started the column really off the back of that. But obviously now the column is dominated entirely on the extraordinary language that you get from the war.
How does it change the way that you listen to news reports on the BBC or look at copy in the papers in Britain? Do you notice these words making their way into the reporting of war as well?
Oh, very much so. I mean, because I write this column every day, obviously I have to look out for these phrases. But even before I was writing it, I mean, I was really struck by some of the utterly ridiculous terms that military experts, it's sort of armchair generals, even those out serving in the Gulf, come up with these extraordinary phrases.
Give me a couple of examples of what's in the utterly ridiculous column for you.
I think the utterly ridiculous column would obviously have to be cakewalk, which I think was first coined by Ken Adelman, who's obviously the hawk of all hawks in Washington. And he famously said before the war started that it would be a cakewalk, that the troops would be in Baghdad in no time and they would be greeted with rose petals. Obviously, that hasn't happened, and Ken Adelman has been made to look rather ridiculous.
And what about the use of words that are meant to disguise or obfuscate rather than look for some kind of new place in a dictionary? Are you finding lots of that and new examples of that in this war?
Oh, very much so. One that they came up with the other day was they talked, a British military chap talked about how when the British troops go into Basra, they don't want to break the China. And what he means, break the China, is obviously causing a large amount of death. And he was trying to explain the cautious way that British troops try and operate in an urban environment. Obviously, they have plenty of practice from Northern Ireland. So the phrase he had was breaking the China. And another one they come up with is hot contact point. That describes an exchange of fire in which people die.
What kind of reaction are you getting to the column, Nick?
Well, it's quite interesting. A lot of people have phoned up, and because we have quite a successful website, which is read all over the world, it's not just people in the United Kingdom who are interested. People all over the world are interested, and indeed some of our rival publications have started running a similar column.
Thanks for being with us, Nick.
Okay.
We're watching it and appreciate your time on the program. Nicholas Watt is political correspondent for The Guardian in London. Joining us now, two people who study the language of war and the way that it's used from the University of California at Berkeley. We have with us the professor of linguistics, Robin Lakoff. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Dick.
And joining us from McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, the assistant professor of English, James Dawes. He's also author of a recent book, The Language of War. James, welcome to The Connection.
Good morning.
Did you think when you were writing your book that you would be talking about the language of yet another war in new words?
I was hoping not. but now what's most striking about this war is that the sorts of things one studies in previous wars are being reproduced very similarly now. So the euphemism you've mentioned towards sanitizing the conflict, it goes back to the Civil War even, when you have phrases now like surgical strike. This is an attempt to saturate our images of bodily damage in images of care. So surgery obviously is caring for the body, healing the body. It makes violence seem almost like an act of comfort. This is a way of making us able to contemplate pain and suffering.
Where was this in the Civil War?
Well, back in the Civil War, you have a lot of images, for instance, of imagining the enemy as one colossal body. And this metaphor allows you to contemplate the fact of many bodies piling high, many bodies having many limbs dismembered, but it's actually only one imaginary body, and this imaginary body suffers wounds but never dies, so it sanitizes the conflict and makes pain something you can talk about without having to vividly picture.
Robin Lakoff, tell me whether or not any of your linguistic classes at UCB have been distracted by the words of war. Are you able to stay on, should I say, on target? I guess perhaps not.
Well, the courses I teach tend to have we do a lot of examination of the various kinds of effects of language and why people choose the language that they do. So we have done some talking about it, but it hasn't been a distraction.
What are you noticing? What are you hearing that's new or novel this time around, Robin?
It isn't so much the words themselves, although there are some interesting new words, and I think Nicholas in particular was mentioning some. But what I find amazing is how very active the administration has been in putting words in, putting in language from above. Because it seems to me that in the past, the tendency has been to pick up the words from the field, and then gradually they get transferred to the media, and then maybe they get taken up by the administration, and eventually they waft out to everyone. But here they seem to start at government, Defense Department press conferences, and from there they go out to the media and to everyone else.
Do you mean phrases like...
So it's really the government retaining control.
Like regime change? Is that an example of one that's come from the top?
That's one, I think. Let's see. I think I first heard embedding at a press conference. I don't know.
That was a Pentagon phrase.
Started it.
Yeah.
Pentagon.
Yeah.
Shock and awe.
Is there something to embedding that you think bears examination?
I don't know. I sort of like that word, but I hate it. What I find interesting about it is people have asked, which of these words do you think is likely to remain in the language after all this is blessedly over? And my candidate, I think, is going to be embedding, because I think it adapts itself so well to metaphorical and other figurative uses. But what's interesting, again, about embedding is it's the word itself, which is a rather odd word, and it strikes me as kind of maybe created by someone with a bit of a tin ear, which is the problem of some of these new words. But what they're doing in embedding journalists with the troops is a very good way to be sure that only one particular part of the story and only one kind of story is apt to be told. So it's a very good example itself of government control over the discourse of this war.
James, one of the things that you've written about is the way that words are used to describe whoever the enemy is. And in the Second World War, for example, there were lots of words used to demonize the Germans and the Japanese. But this war poses a bit of a puzzle for the people who would do that, because they're not trying to apply the same kind of blanket sense of hatred or dislike of Iraqis, but rather just of the one man, of the leader Saddam Hussein and those around him.
I think that's right. But I should emphasize, though, the images of the enemy are getting increasingly violent and dehumanizing. Before the war began, the enemy was really just a target. We didn't have a strong image of who they were. When they began to resist, you began to hear language which made them seem like animals or waste or filth. There was a lot of image of filth.
Give me an example. What were you hearing?
Well, there was talk about mopping up resistance or cleaning out pockets of resistance. You mop up filth. You mop up human waste. You clean out pockets of sort of microbial infection. And this casual refiguring of the enemy as less than fully human is part of how we as a culture rhetorically arm ourselves for the job of killing people. At the same time,
One thing that struck me is that certainly before the war started, there seemed to be a split. It was as if we needed to find somebody to call bad names, and for various reasons we didn't want to use the Iraqis in that role. And so our candidate was the French. And so we had, you were hearing a great deal about cheese-eating surrender monkeys and so on. So it was almost as if in war, when you're gearing up for war, you have to have an enemy to call by bad names, and we will find one, even if it can't be the normal one.
And of course, it happens on the other side as well. In recent news conferences that various leaders of the Iraqi government have held, they've talked about mercenaries fighting for the United States, about evil ones making their way across the desert. There's also a lot in here about sports, the sports rhetoric of war. I was thinking of that today because everybody is talking about whether or not the American troops are at or inside the red zone, the 20 yards from the touchdown line in football. Is that something that we've seen over a period of time? James, maybe you can start on that.
Yeah, I think the image of the game is really important for this war. It's fulfilling three functions. First, what's important about a game, and as you say, there's the red zone, there's talk of how the Iraqis read our offense. You have these ex-military people on the TV for all the world, like NFL sports commentators, you know, retired football players. There's a lot of sports imagery which is saturating this conflict, and it performs three functions. First, in a game, of course, the violence looks very real, but it's not. There are no consequences in the real world to this violence. The second thing about a game is that it has no moral complexity. Nobody wonders in a game, should I be here? Is it the right thing to do to win this game? The whole point of a game is that the moral question is evacuated. And third, and I think this is the most important for this conflict, when a game ends, it ends. Hostility ceases. No one holds bad feelings. There's no mess to clean up afterwards. You shake hands, the victor is happy, and the loser is graceful. And we have a deep fear that this conflict is not going to end when it ends. There could be blowback for generations to come. That frightens us terribly. So it's important to use language which kind of enacts a fantasy of everything being okay once the shooting stops.
Do you think that this is done intentionally, or that we've just learned to do this?
I think a lot of this is just a verbal reflex. These are painful things to talk about and painful things to imagine. And so we seek comforting language. We seek familiar phrases. We seek ways to make it easier to talk about without always having to imagine the horrible consequences. So, for instance,
let me just stop you there if I can, James, sure, because we've got to take a short break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Connection listeners, we do want to hear from you about what you're hearing from either the battlefield or the journalist where you're getting your news. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. The language of war. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're listening to and talking about the language of war this hour. On the program with me, Jim Dawes is Assistant Professor of English at McAllister College, author of The Language of War. Robin Lakoff's joining us from the University of California at Berkeley. She's a professor of linguistics and studies the role of language in politics. Her most recent book is The Language Wars, which is not necessarily about conflict, but certainly about the battles over language. And Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you about what you're hearing. Let's take a listen, for example, to something that was said earlier today at the Central Command briefing in Doha, Qatar.
First, the red zone, or the red lines that we describe, is simply a term that characterizes that there may be a trigger line where the regime deems sufficient threat to use weapons of mass destruction.
So, Robin, when you listen to them talking about red zones and red lines, are you hearing the same sports analogies that Jim was talking about?
I don't know if those are sports analogies. They strike me as an attempt to, first create jargon as a kind of way of separating the speaker from the people who are being spoken to, a way of saying, I'm in authority, I know what's going on here.
Because I've got special language?
A special language, uh-huh. A kind of bureaucraties or worries. And it's a way of saying, I know something you don't know. You probably have never heard these words, or you certainly haven't assimilated them fully into your vocabulary. So you better listen to me.
One of the important things about that, actually, that professionalizing language that Robin's pointing out, it serves to make us, I think, feel like there can be some control applied to the battlefield. The whole point of war, of course, is that it is chaos. The point of war is that it can't be controlled. And this is terribly frightening. So if you can create a language which is sort of rich and complex jargon, which alienates the listener, as she says, sees that person as an authority and then begins to trust that this phenomena of war can be controlled. It's almost like science.
But Robin, what
do
we make of...
It's like what people... It almost creates a regression to childhood when you were learning language at your mother's knee for the first time. And the people who were giving you the words were people of unquestioned authority and unquestioned benevolence in your eyes. And here it's almost as if people are put in a childlike position of you have to learn the words from me. And as long as you trust me and trust my language, everything's going to be all right.
But sometimes it doesn't work, Robin. I mean, if we take a look at the phrase shock and awe, I'm not sure whether or not that is still carried around with the same reverence as it was the moment it was handed to us from the folks in Washington.
Yeah, you have to be a little careful. And you could argue that before you put in these strong and positive terms, very encouraging terms, you really ought to be very, very sure that the result will match the language. So in other words, if our initial thrust falls short of full-out shock and awe, this is going to be taken up by Leno and Letterman, and the next thing you know, the language turns on you, and you lose control. So, it requires a certain amount of delicate manipulation, and I think I was saying this administration, although it's very interested in maintaining that kind of control, sometimes it fails to achieve it.
Should we, Jim, look at the words weapons of mass destruction as a success in terms of taking a collection of words and putting those into common parlance?
It's been a success for getting people to go to war. That phrase was filled with so much terror by this administration that it began to seem as if merely possessing weapons of mass destruction anywhere in the world was justification for being killed. And I think that was done rather well. The war has been motivated in large part by that sort of fear.
Let's take our first call now from Raleigh, North Carolina. Josh is on the phone. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to comment from having been a former military officer and obviously being involved in some of the terminology and being familiar with it. Before I comment, though, I kind of wanted to preface this with I get the distinct feeling that, particularly from the two guests you have, that there seems to be this nuanced disdain for the military and kind of this perception as though there's an insidious organization hiding in the Pentagon coming up with phraseology and pejoratives and superlatives that make the business of doing war, which is by nature ugly and frightening, seem to be a little more palatable to the public. And in my own personal experiences, while there are phrases and terms like shock and awe that do find their way out of think tanks in D.C. and some higher level military leaders in the D.C. area, the majority of them either being expressed in the use of doctrine or just being used in daily communications between individuals in the field are things that are kind of just born out of experiences, and not a lot of thought goes into that and into how it's going to be perceived by people in the public. And most assuredly, there are not a bunch of field commanders and trigger pullers up there in the field saying, well, if we present something in this manner, it's going to cover up the horrors of what we're having to do, and maybe we're going to garner some additional support at home.
Josh, stay with me if you will, because I'd like to hear from both guests on that. I think it's an interesting point that you raise. Robin, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think it is an interesting and a good point that language never starts all in one place. And certainly, just as the caller points out, some of our new terms for this war do originate in the field, as with every war. And in fact, jargon itself has a double function. And there's the one that we've been talking about, which is sometimes obfuscation and the instituting of authority. But it also functions among its users as a kind of a way of bringing them together, as a way of saying, we all understand each other. We therefore can trust each other. And also, it's a way, as I think the caller also suggested, of being efficient. You know, here is this term that covers a lot of material. And if you understand it and I understand it, we can save some time. So, yes, certainly not everything originates from above. Certainly not all war talk is devised purposely for an aim, you know, for an outside aim.
Okay, Robin, the other thing that Josh is saying is that when all that language lands in the laps of lay people like you and me, we kind of take a sneering, dismissive look at it, or will apply all sorts of intentions that the language is meant to disguise the death and destruction.
You know, it all depends, as a former president might have said, on what you mean by mean. That is, people do use words consciously, obviously, but we don't always plan with full intention. Mm-hmm. If I make up this word, it will be used by so-and-so and have the effect on public policy of such-and-such.
Right.
So it's kind of intermediate. But I think it's, I did not intend to sneer. I find creation of new language a vital thing, a very interesting thing. But I think we should bear in mind, without sneering, we should bear in mind that language can be used to deceive and obfuscate. It isn't always by any means, including here, but people need to be on the alert that that can happen.
Jim Dawes, let's hear from you on this.
I think the caller makes a great point, and I don't think this is something to sneer at. War puts tremendous pressure on language for civilians and soldiers alike, and when people use these euphemisms, when they create an internal language, for instance, in the army, they're just doing what humans do. They're trying to make sense of and survive in an environment that they don't have a vocabulary for. And if it's really hard to say, for instance, our goal this weekend is to kill as many people as are left alive as possible, but it's easier psychically for yourself to say, we're going to mop up the resistance, you're going to do it. And you're not trying to trick people. You're not trying to deceive people. There's no pervasive plan to kind of have a master plot of deception. It's just how we survive when we have to face very painful things and talk about them all day long.
What about it, Josh, as a coping mechanism? And is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a coping mechanism for individuals and cultures.
Josh, let's hear from you.
I think that's a reasonable point. I would revert to my previous statement that the majority of the language, like any profession, is designed, and the first guest touched on this briefly, is designed to allow professionals efficient discourse. And there are some very complex aspects of conducting war. You look at the theater that we're in now, there are a lot of moving pieces, and to be kind of long-winded and to speak more along the lines as if you were, some Viking, Eric the Red, talking about raping and pillaging and killing, it's probably not as accurate as you need to be, and it's not how those organizations train. It's not how they expect to communicate with one another.
One of my favorites, Josh, is the phrase blue on blue, which is now being used to describe people who are killed by soldiers on their own side. It used to be friendly fire. Now it's blue on blue. And I gather that comes from war games when the bad guys are traditionally dressed in red
Absolutely. That's exactly where it comes from. Many of the training centers around the United States where friendly forces were referred to as blue forces and the enemy forces were referred to as red icons or red forces.
And I'm just wondering, and Josh, I'll thank you for your call and turn back to my guest. Jim, maybe you can help me with this. The term blue on blue might be said at a military briefing, but the reason it gets to the public is that some reporter thinks it's a sexy collection of words and then repeats that instead of taking the complex professional terminology, as Josh has described it, and putting it into something that's more precise. People get kind of turned on by the idea of adopting this professional language, don't they?
That's right. And I think in some cases, that's a very specific strategy. I don't think with blue on blue people are trying to deceive, but you see, for instance, phrases like the coalition forces being picked up by the media because that's a phrase that is sort of, it has a sense of excitement that you don't get from repeating every time U.S. and British forces.
Like the Rebel Alliance, you know.
Right. And of course, it's not true. I mean, there isn't a coalition in any real sense. It's U.S. forces backed by a small contingent of British. But it serves a purpose. It makes it seem like this is an international venture.
Let's go to back to our lines. Our number, incidentally, is 1-800-423-8255. To Rocky Mountain, North Carolina now. And Joseph. Hi, Joseph.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to add something that not only the words, but I think delivery is something that's important. I think if you compare a lot of the military news conferences from the first Gulf War, there was almost a giddiness when they talked about these terms that you've talked about this morning that are kind of whitewashing of real things, collateral damage, friendly fire. But I remember that, especially with the video, they would kind of be giddy at showing it. And I don't see that in this time from the military. That's not to say that you shouldn't take everything they say with a grain of salt and go to alternate news sources. But I think delivery is very important in addition to the words.
What do you think has changed? Why is that sort of delight or giddiness not a part of taking those words?
I think it's a combination of a couple things. I think that probably over the past 10 years, the military learned that while at first it was probably a boon to them to kind of be giddy and show this video-style warfare, I think they learned as truth came out that the first Gulf War wasn't as clean as they said. I think that also is supported by the fact that they're doing this embedded, that they understand that part of what they have to do is for domestic consumption and to get domestic support is to be as upfront as they can without being totally, open and say, you know, we killed these people today or, you know, these
right.
people got killed. I think they generally understand both for domestic and for foreign consumption because I think the Arab on the street is a lot of news outlets are calling it, that opinion is very important.
Robin, what are you hearing in the difference or the distinction between the language that was used in 91 and today? Are you hearing some of what Joseph's describing?
I've noticed that military spokespeople do seem to be, you know, much more professional. They sound military. They sound crisp and to the point. And aside from Donald Rumsfeld at the very top, they don't seem to be having a lot of fun. Although one thing that you do notice, or I think is true, is that news anchors and reporters seem to be having a very good time in the sense that when they talk about war stories, you can hear their voices become more buoyant and excited. And if they have to report a story, let's say, on taxes, their voices kind of flatten out. So this is kind of a worrisome thing, that war is always exciting, particularly to people who aren't in the middle of it.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Certainly one of the characters in the in this particular conflict who's received a lot of attention for his use of language is the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and he was questioned on a television program earlier and gave us a little insight into perhaps a different perspective of the way that he uses language. Let's listen to Donald Rumsfeld.
We missed.
You said you missed.
Well, he's still standing.
That is General Sultan Hashim Ahmed, the defense minister, who was having a briefing while the bombing of military installation was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Their defense ministry is still intact.
What's your point?
Why would the defense ministry still be operational?
Obviously, we didn't hit it.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, certainly not mincing his words as he looks at a piece of video alongside a television host. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And, Jim, when you listen to the secretary in a situation like that, I mean, he, in fact, takes the simplicity of language and turns it to his advantage when a lot of people around him are taking refuge in words like deceased individuals as opposed to dead people.
That's right. But I think what you're seeing in a moment like that is a developing sense of frustration on his part. And this frustration, I think, is going to lead to a change in how we use language in this war. What's happening right now, we're in a transition moment. You're seeing a process called amplification and reversal. So before, we didn't really have to dehumanize the enemy too much because we weren't frustrated by the enemy. Now that we're frustrated, we're seeing something that's making us very uncomfortable. We're seeing an enemy which is resisting with features that closely approximate courage. These are people who are fighting against all odds. These are people who are sacrificing their lives. And it's very uncomfortable for us to have this idea that maybe they're displaying courage, because the whole premise of this war is that only madmen and psychopaths would fight for this terrible regime. And, of course, we shouldn't associate courage with them. So what's happening is that those features which look like courage, we're going to, as we get more and more frustrated, amplify them to an extreme so they begin to look like the opposite of courage. So it's not courage, it's fanaticism. That was Newsweek today. It's not courage, it's people don't know the value of their own lives. It's not courage, it's something like zombies. One quotation talked about people, we shoot them, they get up, and they keep coming.
Hemingway did this, too. Didn't he want to just do away with words like courage and honor and glory in his own look at what he'd seen at war?
He did. For him, it was because that glorifying, ennobling language accelerated violence. It made us excited about violence. It allowed us to delight in destruction.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A conversation about the language of war this hour, and we'd like to hear from you about what you're hearing. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, Jim Dawes, Assistant Professor of English at Macalester College. He has a new book out called The Language of War. And Robin Lakoff's joining us from a studio at the University of California at Berkeley. She studies the role of language in politics. Her book about that is called The Language War. She's a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. And Robin, I wanted to, if you've not seen a copy of Jim's book yet, point to a point that he makes early on in the book, and that is that in many cases, violence and war throttles off language. Jim points to the Whitman poem, "Beat, beat drums, blow, bugles, blow, make no parley, stop for no expostulation, mind not the timid," and so on. The idea being that as soon as you have resorted to war, then the value or the usefulness of language is gone. And Robin, I don't know whether or not in the study of linguistics you look at the kind of throttling off of language as people resort to violence.
Well, you see that in a couple of ways. First, it's true that many cultures have proverbs of the sort, acts are masculine, deeds, words are feminine, actions count, words don't. So there is a tension between active things like war and less important, more passive things like language. And another way that you can look at this this kind of split is that when war happens, a whole range of expressiveness in a democracy starts to become throttled. So, for instance, I was listening yesterday to a lot of discussion on various news shows, which one of our generals had criticized the conduct of the war, and others were coming in. I think this was on the NewsHour last night, and calling him out and out disloyal, suggesting that anyone who criticized the conduct of the war, let alone criticized our being engaged in the war at all, was a traitor or something very close to it. So one of the things that war does, it polarizes language. It forces a choice between language that's totally supportive, you are 100% with us, or anything short of that, you're against us, you're suspect, you're a traitor. And in a democracy, this is a very dangerous thing. We find, again, as we look back at the history of American language at times of war, that speech, free speech, is very often an early victim.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Kim's on the line. Hi, Kim.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I just want to make a comment. I saw that same show. It was on the Lehrer NewsHour, and I was convinced had those two military personnel been in the same studio, we might have seen a fist fight. That was that level of anger, which I was equally concerned about. But
yeah,
comment,
I found that quite surprising.
Yeah, it looked like he wanted to jump through the TV screen, and it was shocking. But my comment related to today's subject is related to using familiar language to describe a novel situation. I'm thinking about a story that the Washington Post originally ran, I think about a week ago, where a group of U.S. Marines compared their movements to being in a turkey shoot. And associated with that were the concerns about the levels of resistance, questions about U.S. preparedness, and American expectations of an easy victory. And then along that line, you had Governor Wallace or General Wallace's comment about this isn't the war I game for. And my comment was is that it seemed like that was it was interesting because it was our soldiers comparing themselves to animals, essentially. And I think it was probably very honest representation of what their emotions were at the time, and I do see the media has just jumped on that. And to dovetail what the professor from Berkeley is saying, I think the media has been demonized in this. I'm looking at the two pages of opinion in the Greensboro News and Record, and one headline reads, Coalition in Trouble, No, Media is Wrong, and Cal Thomas is suggesting that journalists are the enemy of the coalition, and just my comment about the language.
All right, Kim. Let me turn to Jim, because Jim, this notion that it's not the problem that the Army's having, but the media is having its own little word fest, and they're wrong. I mean, I suppose that you could quarrel with whether that's right or that's wrong, but again, it takes the attention away from the issues and brings it back to who's saying what and what words are being used.
I think that's right. I mean, euphemism takes us further from reality. And she mentioned the euphemism of comparing soldiers to animals. There's been a lot of that. A lot of it, most of it that I've heard, has been directed against the Iraqis. We talk about hunting them down or flushing them out. And one thing I kind of want to emphasize, we've been talking a lot about how this language might affect the enemy that we're kind of attacking with this language. But it also has an effect on us. This language, which dehumanizes the enemy, which animalizes the enemy, has a real harmful effect on our own soldiers. People who have worked with veterans of previous wars, say, for instance, Vietnam, they say that when soldiers are saturated in language which makes their enemy seem like an animal or seem like filth, this hurts the soldier because it evacuates any sense that the soldier was involved in a heroic enterprise. They can't be proud of going out and shooting contemptible animals. They are filthy if they're in contact with filth. To dehumanize the enemy actually makes it harder for many veterans returning to war, returning from war, to psychically recover from the wounds of war.
The idea being that it would be a more noble enterprise to say to the soldiers, these are people out here, they stand for this, our leaders have made a decision that we're going to kill them for these reasons, so let's do that job?
There have been many wars that have been fought where people allow themselves to think of the enemy as a professional soldier, where they allow themselves to think of the enemy as somebody with human qualities, for instance, perhaps courage. And that they could have a sense that they faced a worthy opponent, and when they came back from the war, that they had been engaged in a human activity, even though it was a violent activity. But the more we move toward language of dehumanization, the more it just seems like a filthy process, and people return with shame.
1-800-423-8255 to McGregor, Iowa now. Phil's on the line. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The word I'd like to comment on is the change of name of soldier to warfighter. And I think I'd like the guest to comment on Warfighter.
I saw that yesterday, but I just glanced at it, Phil, and I'm not sure where it came from. Do you know who first put that word out there?
I don't. It's on the Internet. It's kind of unique to this war, but I think it maybe relates to the fact that we dismissed the United Nations. It's pretty hard to call preemptive invasion peacekeeping.
Right.
So now our soldiers are warfighters. And maybe this is a language change we need to go forward.
Just stick around, Phil. Robin, what do you think about this? Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it, but it's very interesting. It's almost as if we're creating a euphemism that, and I think the caller is suggesting that somehow we aren't convinced that the business that soldiers usually do is a good thing. So we're trying to make it by words into something more glamorous.
Jim, maybe by making them appear tougher because they're not just soldiers standing on guard, but they're fighters fighting a war.
It could be. I have to say, I find that a strange phrase. But what I think it points to is that there are a lot of alternative vocabularies for describing conflict. I mean, we've been focusing a lot on vocabularies which dehumanize or sanitize, but there are alternatives. And in fact, one really important alternative to look at is the alternative language of humanitarian law. This gives us a vocabulary for talking about war very accurately, which I think limits barbarism, which in fact makes the conflict something more humane.
This is like the language you'd find in the Geneva Conventions, for example.
Exactly, the Geneva Conventions. This is language that was created internationally in international treaties, and it gives us phrases, for instance, like prisoner of war. What's really important about prisoner of war is that when you have someone standing before you, they are not a terrorist. They are not an enemy of God. In fact, they're not an enemy anymore. They're prisoner of war. And your own soldiers, when they're in the enemy's hands, are also prisoners of war. There's a moral equivalence between all those prisoners. And when that reciprocal relationship is set up, that I am like them, that their prisoners are like my prisoners, there's a pressure to think, well, I want my prisoners to be treated the way I would like to be treated. So I will treat their prisoners with some humanity too. So it pressures us toward a certain kind of humanity and reduces the violence a little bit. It gives us some pressure toward morality. And this is part of what things like the Geneva Conventions can do. But they only work if we have a sense of an international community, if we believe in this language, if we support this language, if we support these international treaties, and if we've done work, as the U.S. has prior to this, to subvert the idea that there can be an international community that can create international moral norms.
Just back to Phil for a minute, if I can. Phil, when you hear a word like warfighter, is it your instinctive reaction to wonder where it comes from and why it's being used?
Yeah, I did have that reaction, and it's one word, and it replaces soldier, and I questioned where it came from. This is a very interesting discussion to me because I think language is extremely important.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Yep.
Jim Dawes, I was watching a video not a few, maybe just a couple of weeks ago, of the Vietnam War, and noted in that the North Vietnamese heading south were going south to liberate people, and that the Americans in the south holding them back were calling that liberation an invasion. And it just sort of jumped out at me because, of course, the juxtaposition of the two phrases is reversed in this war, with the United States saying this is liberation and the Iraqis saying this is an invasion. Do you think that we are as aware as we should be of how these terms are used to try and load our understanding of conflict in the books that we read, in the magazine articles or the newspapers that we read?
Well, I mean, just to stick with the phrase liberation, this is language which Americans, I think, are peculiarly susceptible to. We always want to believe that part of our deepest aspiration about ourselves is that we are creating new worlds. Mm-hmm. We were founded as a new world, and we want to deliver new worlds of freedom to people. This is the story we tell ourselves. So when language like liberation is used to describe what is an invasion, it moves us to feel like this can be something we support. But I think when you take that same language and you apply it to the Iraqi people, I mean, these are people who for more than a decade have been suffering death from embargoes and war. A lot of it they blame on America. I think that language makes no sense. It seems utterly bizarre and is lost on them.
Robin, what about you? What's the phrase that jangles in your ear when you hear it in reference to this war? Is there one that you nudge the person sitting next to you and say, did you hear that?
Let's see. Well, let's see. I've mentioned embedding, but more as a problem about what it's about. One phrase that annoys me is the term coalition of the willing. And this, again, seems to be an administration tin ear problem that, you know, it seems much weaker than it ought to be. So shock and awe, which is another that's annoying, is annoying because it's hyperbolic. You know, it's much stronger than really it should have been. And coalition of the willing sounds like, well, here's a bunch of people who sort of have nothing better to do, so they're willing.
Yeah.
Where what we really need and can't have for reasons of reality is a term like coalition of the totally committed, coalition of people who really, really want to be in it.
I'll work on an acronym for that one. There's a darker and more serious side to the way that language is used. When I was looking at your book, Jim, one that jumped out at me was Goring's use in 1941 of the final solution. He used those words because there weren't any other words to describe what it was that either he chose not to or could not even himself describe.
That's right. That's right.
Well, there were words, but he didn't want to use them.
There are words that are very painful to hear and painful to say. And it was of incredible importance to people involved in the final solution to not be able to say what they had to do. They were able to maintain their sort of psychic balance by being able to lie to themselves with the vocabulary about what was happening.
So there's a light side to this, but there's also a very serious one that we need to keep our eyes open to.
Absolutely. And the thing we need to keep in mind is how much war really damages language. Euphemism is damaged language. Maybe the summary image of what happens to language in wartime is this short story about the Civil War called Chickamauga by Ambrose Bierce, which ends with this picture of a soldier who has had the bottom half of his face shot off. So between his nose and his throat, there's just a red gap. And he's gurgling and hissing, trying to communicate with a deaf-mute child who is himself gurgling and hissing. And it ends with this image of violence overseeing the end of all coherent human speech.
Okay, I'll think about that for a while. Jim Dawes, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Jim is Assistant Professor of American Literature at McAllister College and author of The Language of War. Robin Lakoff, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Robin's a professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, author of The Language War. Earlier in the program, we talked with Nicholas Watt, political correspondent with The Guardian newspaper. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.